The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, there you go.
April 6th.
So we're glad it's a small group. I think it'll be easier to maybe take some questions and make it more interactive. I actually think that this is, although Myra and I have been thinking about this for a while and spent a lot of time muddling over this morning, I think it's one of the kind of tougher sessions to talk about. It's a little bit ambiguous, for lack of a better word, which is that it's kind of somewhat easy to take intellectual property law and say, okay, start with a survey if you're interested in this, move in that direction, and kind of do a flow chart. And I think with the general curriculum, what we're talking about, as we've said in some of the academic advising sessions, is you're either thinking about, I don't know if I want to focus on an area, or I don't know yet that I'm going to focus on an area, so how do I get started, how do I get going? And I actually think at the end of the day, fully half of each year's graduating class probably ends up being what I would consider a general, well-rounded graduate, somebody who's taken courses in a number of areas, maybe dabbled a little bit further in one area, but by no means graduated with the notion of, I'm now an IP, freshly minted, I don't know why I'm picking on my IP, but freshly minted IP graduate, I'm ready to go in there. And of course, when we give individual advice, we'll say to students, it can cut both ways, and say, if you want to work in a niche area, that's great, and if that's what your interest has been, follow up and go in that regard. But the narrower it is, the greater risk you might have. Think about some of the telecom folks back in the day and the notion that they were going to take whatever was available in their school, and then, the so-called bubble burst and there's nothing to do in that regard. And the question is, are you then a good, well-rounded attorney, or do you need to switch gears and find yourself auditing classes at a law school, the year after you graduate and whatnot? So I think asking the questions or thinking about it now makes a lot of sense. What Myra and I talked about the last couple of days in preparing for this was to kind of start with, okay, what do we have left? What do you have left? When you finish the first year, or let's say you finish the first year and your two required courses, your Crim Pro and your Ethics, you're going to have about 51 credits remaining. We figure that averages out to about 17 classes, and that's just assuming a basic math, an average three-credit class. So what could you do with that? What would you think about in terms of courses that we think are kind of maybe must-take courses? We risk this, particularly when we're going to put it on a podcast and record it, that there are going to be faculty who feel that, their courses you definitely need to be taking, and happy to not mention that. And that's a chance we take, but that's, we'll bear that risk. So we kind of thought, we worked on a little bit of a list, and I'll throw out a couple of things here, and I'm going to invite Myra to either disagree and or chime in. Couple of classes I think right off the top that are going to make just perfect general sense. And a lot of this, again, if it's obvious, too great, it's a confirmation. If it's not, we can talk some more about why this or why that, why something might have been left off. We kind of thought this was a little bit of March Madness, like right after Selection Day. Why didn't this team make it and why didn't that one make it? And there's no hard and fast rule. You can go and Google the information. You're not going to find law schools that say this is exactly what you want to take. But we thought right off the top, three classes at least that I thought were kind of gimmies. BA, business associations, which on the bar you'll see is corporations, is also going to be your informal, if not in one or two cases, formal prerequisites for other corporate law classes, basic federal income tax, and evidence. And evidence, for those of you who did or if you did not attend the 1L advising sessions, the general section by section we did, because we know it's going to appear on the bar, virtual certainty, unless you sit for one or two bars, it makes sense to take it, if not just for that. But again, a number of you are going to need it as a prerequisite or a co-requisite for courses here. And then beyond that, just the general good sense of having that litigation skill makes perfect sense. I was sharing with Myra that an alum from several years back, who's very well regarded in the Supreme Court practice area, had been asked a couple of years ago that kind of typical question you ask of an alum when they're invited back to a panel: what classes would you have taken in hindsight? Knowing now, if you'd known then what you know now, and we assume with the Supreme Court practice, you're going to say more con law, more advanced con law, and he said business courses. He said, because there are Supreme Court cases, appellate cases that I'm taking on that have transactional components to them. And without having a little bit of that background, I'm a little bit in the weeds, and obviously an intelligent individual, but a little bit in the weeds in terms of knowing what to do. And as I shared before, we do have a number of students also gravitate to WCL with their interest in human rights, public interest commitment, which is great, but it oftentimes means kind of moving in the direction opposite from corporate law type courses. And so, you know, BA is just really a perfect kind of foundational course, if it ends up being nothing more than that, for, you know, some of you and for other students to consider. So kind of the core courses we thought in that area. Talked about skill sets, about kind of balancing, and there are a couple of different things. One is just a minimum, and you have to do it as a requirement, but at least one, if not a couple, practical skills component, something that has a simulation component to it. It might be oral advocacy, it might be written advocacy in terms of, you know, writing memos, memoranda, either a series of them or maybe building upon one over the course of a semester. We're talking about appellate advocacy, you know, in that regard. And also just the difference between kind of writing in terms of test taking, whether you're somebody who's looking to kind of run away from writing, you had a bad or having a bad experience in legal rhetoric and feel the last thing you want to be doing is working on enhancing those skills, well, all the more reason you should be thinking about one or more seminars where you know it's going to be paper-based and that you're going to have an opportunity to develop some skill sets in that regard. Ideally with input from a professor over the course of a semester. You heard each of us speak in the academic advising sessions about when you're doing your upper level writing requirement to see if you can assure for yourself that you're working with a professor who's not simply looking to accept an initial outline and then say, okay, make sure you get the final paper to me during the reading period, because there's no real substantive feedback if you're doing that. So getting at least another pair of eyes of somebody who's working on a course with you. And again, that could be through a seminar that you're taking that's also of interest to you. Could also be through an independent study. An obvious way to do it is to just approach a professor and say, I'm really interested in working in this area of scholarship or writing with you. And again, I know we covered that in the advice session. Negotiation and mediation skills, another area, you know, clearly just an obvious good practical skills component. Whether you're looking at lawyer bargaining, ADR, alternative dispute resolution, pretrial lit or pretrial litigation, these again are some negotiation mediation skills. Interaction, you know, interacting with other individuals and with the instructors, whether they're judges in this case or adjuncts with whom you're working. From a general standpoint as well, kind of tucked into that rubric is to try to assure for yourself that you have a mix of smaller classes thrown in, that you're not finding yourselves in the 50s and 60s and 70s. If you're somebody who has been, you know, did not have a great Socratic method experience or just kind of felt, okay, I did enough in the first year, I don't want to go back into that, again, all the more reason, because you're going to be enhancing, you're going to be sought after for these skills as an attorney, to ensure that you're in some of these smaller seminars where you're really forced to have the interaction, not just with a professor, but with other students in a class that's a dozen, maybe no more than 14 students. It might have, again, a skill set or simulation component to it, but something that is forcing you to, again, not only be engaged, but to be thinking actively in the class as well, because that professor is looking at each one of you virtually every class for some kind of input of some type. And so it's going to keep those skills developing, kind of building upon the first year. Jump in on there, build on that.
A couple things about, in particular, writing. And for those of you who either write on or grade on to Law Review or Journal, you're certainly going to get a plethora of legal research and writing skills in your 2L year, not only in writing your comment, but also in the spading process. And spading, for those of you who don't know what that is basically fact-checking and site-checking. So that's where you're assigned a portion of an article and you have to go to the library and find the sources that the author uses and cites to. If you don't get onto Law Review or Journal, it's imperative that you write, I think, at least one paper a year. You're going into a profession where writing is the, I think, biggest means of communication, even outside of oral advocacy, because not every attorney is a litigator or, you know, an appellate advocate. And so writing is crucial. And a lot of students go through legal rhetoric and they get very frustrated and they feel like, oh, you know, such a hard process learning how to write like an attorney, which it is, and all the more reason to hone those skills and to practice those skills. I'll give you an example of myself. I was not on Law Review or Journal when I was here at WCL. I wrote four papers after my 1L year. Over the course of my 2L and 3L year, because I knew that I needed to work on my writing skills. And so don't be afraid of those classes. Don't be afraid of taking paper classes, because that's the only way that you're going to improve upon that skill. And it's critical. And don't forget, it's also a great way to possibly get published, not using the law review journal, the law review or journal route, because realistically, most students who write their comments will not get published in law review or journal. It's only a small percentage, but there are many students who write papers independently of law review who do get published. So keep that in mind, that research and writing are very, very critical. And I can say, I was an associate at a big law firm after I graduated from WCL, and one of the things that my supervising attorneys told me was, you're a very good writer, and it's because I kept working on that skill throughout law school. So please keep that in mind. I think that's very important in terms of figuring out which courses to take, and you'll find a lot of that in smaller seminars where you get to write an independent, research paper or going through an independent study project with a professor. You're listing the...
I'm just writing some stuff on the board here. We'll go over.
Okay. Second thing about the... Going back to BA tax and evidence, you all really should take evidence. I mean, I've yet to come across a student who's graduating who says, oh yeah, I didn't take evidence. I mean, you know the evidence is going to be tested on the bar exam if for that only reason that you take the course. If you're someone who has no interest in going into litigation, that's fine. Take evidence your last semester of law school, but take evidence. Please take evidence. The law is not a bubble. The law is not a vacuum. You're going to find that... You could be a criminal attorney and have to deal with a corporate law issue. I was a labor and employment attorney. I dealt with corporate law issues all the time. I dealt with tax issues all the time. So keep that in mind when you're registering for courses over the course of the next four semesters, that yes, you may be a human rights attorney, but you may have a client who has, a corporate law issue, and it's good to at least have some foundation in that and some knowledge about it. You may not be an expert, and that's okay, but to know that you took those classes in law school and you can at least give them some baseline, advice, and then maybe have to refer them out to somebody else. But it's always important to remember that the legal field is a very wide field. It's a very broad field, and you could encounter any issue that comes up in any practice area at any point in time when you're out there practicing.
Do you recommend taking tax in our second year, or can we do, if we have no desire to be a litigating attorney, with evidence, we take it in our third year?
I think that's depends upon if you want to be a tax attorney. Yeah, you should probably take tax fall semester of your 2L year because you want to show on your resume that you have a tax background. If you don't want to be a practicing tax attorney, fit it into when you feel is going to be best for you. Dean Jaffe mentioned the alum who said that he wished he had taken corporations. I didn't take tax, and I wish that I had taken tax. So, think about what you want to do and kind of how you want to build your schedule. And if it's something that, again, like evidence, you feel like you don't need to take it immediately, that's fine. But just, slot it in somewhere so that, again, it makes you more of a well-rounded general practitioner at the end of the day.
So I put a couple of other courses on, and there's no, again, I feel like we need to say this at least twice on the podcast. There's no magic, what makes it difficult. There's no real magic to selecting courses, not selecting courses. But as Meyer and I molded over, we talked about BA tax and evidence. Administrative law or an administrative, type course, something that's going to teach you about administrative regimes. Could be environmental law, could be labor law, but a course in that vein. Wills, trusts, and estates. Some of these courses, what happens is the moment you graduate, you become the family attorney, right? So you're the first one in your family becoming that, and all of a sudden you're the experts in wills and trusts and, tax and everything else. And that doesn't mean you have to get the answers right, but it'd be nice to, that's why some of these courses make kind of that well-rounded attorneys, the type of things, as Meyer said, that come up. Appellate advocacy, we talked about oral and written skills, family law, remedies, the outcomes and results and kind of working towards resolution, and clinic externship, we talked about a little bit. Students could do either and or both, recognizing a number of the clinics when they run two semesters. You're looking at 14 credits. Okay, that's going to be, that's more than a third of your remaining courses. No. Less than a quarter, somewhere around about a quarter of your remaining credits. That's a lot to pick up. It's great. It's a huge experience. The one of the differences, and this isn't really a trade-off. So again, I get grief from both sides if they heard it. But on the one hand, with the clinical program, you're picking up oftentimes, most cases, live clients. That's what it is. It's not simulation. It's actually taking on live clients under the supervision of an instructor or a faculty member. Great to be able to hit the ground running, and or to have that on a resume when you can say, yeah, I've actually actually done this type of work already. On the externship side, you're not typically going to be dealing with clients. You may be in some positions where you're doing some initial intake. You could be working with IUDA, for example, and doing some intake and maybe some light working with clients, but likely not going to court and representation because you don't have the certification to be doing that. On the externship side, at the same time, if you're working in the field in an area, it's kind of a double-edged sword or two sides of, I don't know what the expression is, but if you love the experience, you're not only going to do well, but you're going to be impressing the individuals, presumably with whom you're working, which means you're developing some networking opportunities. These are folks who have a great experience during the summer or during the fall. They're thinking, hey, would you like to come back for the spring? I know you can't do it for an externship again. Maybe we can pay you a little bit. Or, hey, you know what? You've got to come back and drop the resume off because we're real interested in considering working with you. And oftentimes you're going to pick up possible postgraduate opportunity in that regard. So some real networking opportunities there. The clinic side, probably not so much so in terms of attorneys, although at the same time, in another area that I think that's important, to kind of segue into a little bit, and we'll jump back into the classes, getting to know faculty. Huge to get to know faculty. Many of you are going to be thinking about judicial clerkships. The letters of recommendation are the floor. They're not the ceiling anymore, meaning not only do you have to have one, but you want to have one that's standing out. Well, they're going to be looking for them from the faculty who've been teaching you, particularly during the second year when it's a little bit more perhaps individuated than the larger lecture formats in the first year. So getting to know faculty through seminars, or again, it could be a clinic setting, less likely in the second year because there are fewer slots that are open to second year students, but thinking about independent studies, thinking about research assistants during the summer, or what we call dean's fellows during the fall or spring, getting to know faculty, while you may have that, you can have that in the externship setting as well, it'd be more on the seminar side because in the field you're going to be working with attorneys, but again, on the clinic side, you're working with faculty, and so if you're impressing them, you're having opportunities to have them speak for you as well. There are students who will do both externships and clinics, so don't feel that they're mutually exclusive. Just recognize purely from a credit component, you could be looking at upwards of 20 credits of your remaining 51 credits, upwards of 14 in the clinic setting, and then the externship, if you end up completing the requisite or a certain number of hours per week, you're looking at 3 credits in the field and 3 credits of a seminar, at least the first time out. And then I put at the bottom as well, you know, theory. Consider taking one theory course. It's, at a minimum, it's, you know, it's cocktail party conversation. You shouldn't be focusing on politics or, you know, political views and, you know, so you end up focusing on family and things of a general nature and whatnot when you get to get together. But it's more, it's understanding and having an appreciation of the background of the law and, you know, what it's based upon and everything else. So it's a smattering of a little bit of this and that. Again, there are subject areas that, you know, Professor Robbins would push, you know, conflicts of law, and it's a great course to have, and we could debate that. I said this in a couple of the sessions. The hardest thing I think it is for first-year students, and to some degree even for second-year students to do, is that we have a wealth of curricular offers here. And so it's great to have those opportunities, but also means you got to try to narrow it down a little bit. And there's only so much space to do so. I think informal advice from classmates, from upper level students whom you're getting to know, certainly in terms of sometimes winnowing out some faculty where you might have a certain approach to a classroom and that professor doesn't present in the same way. You're not going to get that on the podcast from us. We'll turn it off after. But that kind of, you know, that level of drilling down is a great opportunity to be speaking with some, you know, some classmates in terms of, okay, I'm thinking of evidence. Do I go into this direction with Professor X, this one with Y? And that's, I shouldn't pick on evidence. It could be any number of courses that have several sections from which to choose.
In course evaluations, read course evaluations. Yeah. No? Yes? You look surprised.
No.
You can access course, and a lot of students don't do this, and I don't understand why, but you can access course evaluations on the my.american portal. As you guys have gone through a semester with them, the Office of Academic Affairs compiles course evaluations, and the reason why we do it is because we want students to be candid about their experiences in a class. And if you're thinking of taking a class with a certain professor and you're not sure, you know, you're not familiar with that professor, you don't really know how he or she has taught in previous semesters, utilize the course evaluations. It's a great tool in which you can use, besides using your colleagues, your upper class colleagues, in terms of finding out what a class is like. There's no reason why you should go into a class being completely blind to, you know, what that class may be like. There's ways in which you can find out that information institutionally and otherwise. So utilize the course evaluation process as well, as you're building your schedule and considering what courses to take over the next 2 years rather.
Want to mention the UCC?
The UCC, my favorite. All right, so you guys are like, oh God, contracts. So there are upper-level courses in the Uniform Commercial Code. We offer three. So sales is one, secured transactions, and negotiable instruments, or commercial paper. You may have heard it being referred to that as well. A lot of students who are interested in the business law curriculum will take one or all three if they want to. You know, we encourage students. The UCC, as you know, can be quite a complex thing. So some students, especially if they've struggled with it in contracts, will take an upper level UCC course to get more exposure to it. If you're considering a bar exam jurisdiction that does test either secured transactions or negotiable instruments or both, note about sales. Sales on the bar exam is grouped in together with contracts, so you will see sales on the bar exam because it's tested in the multi-state portion of the bar exam, but not all jurisdictions will test secure transactions or negotiable instruments. If you're not comfortable with the UCC, if you're, you know, as I said, if it's something that you struggled with or didn't quite understand when you took contracts, you may want to consider taking an upper level UCC course. We can talk more in private about which one you'd prefer one over the other, but again, it's something that I recommend to students because I think it's good to know, it's good to have. Again, it's one of those courses I did not take in law school and I probably should have. But that's, you know, that's the UCC in a nutshell.
The you know, gun to a head, the general rule of thumb or the general theory observation has been if a student's going to continue consider one UCC course solely for preparation for the bar, that negotiable instruments tends to be the denser course, the concept of negotiability being a little bit more challenging to get one's arms around. So, you know, sometimes it'll come down to a coin toss and even just kind of fitting it into a schedule during the last semester. But that's you'll hear that from bar prep companies probably and from others as well. So,
but keep in mind, some jurisdictions test secured transactions, but don't test negotiable instruments. So don't make the assumption that, oh, there's a UCC on the bar exam. It must be both. It may not be both. It may be only one. So just always, you know, make sure you check that if you're doing it just for bar exam preparation purposes.
Why don't we take some questions? This is kind of where we were planning on heading. Again, and we could repeat ourselves several times, but it is a little bit. The other thing that I should say will happen oftentimes, and why we often say that the fall semester is kind of a semester prerequisites. Those of you here, those of you listening to the podcast, a number of you are going to end up moving in a certain direction just by dint of what you end up taking or by virtue of your summer experience. It happened for me on a summer study abroad program to a large degree. It could happen in a summer course here, an externship that sends you somewhere. At the same time, you may start taking courses in the fall if you're not doing any summer work and find I'm taking survey courses in three or four areas and none of it really moves me. Well, you end up moving a little bit further. I mean, you can't fill a fall semester with what I would deem to be survey courses in every area. I mean, we haven't touched on immigration law and international law, on human rights, and really for virtually every subject area, there would be, it's not going to say intro to immigration law or intro to international law or whatnot, but there is really essentially a foundational course or a general course for each one. So you arguably could probably cover three of your remaining four semesters in what would be so-called survey courses. It may be you go through a semester and say, okay, nothing's moving me in particular. Be okay with that. I mean, again, we said this during the last week or so. You may end up just continuing to kind of absorb courses of a general nature and work your way along. You know, IP, criminal law, other subject areas that I haven't, you know, labor law, health, on and on and on. And they're going to be bits and pieces where you're going to find a curricular area that has three, four courses, some that have 10, 11, 12. You can continue to work your through it. At the same time, you may pick up a course or two and say, this really is of interest to me. And that's why they talk about the next semester being a little bit of a semester prereqs or foundational courses, because something really moves you, the professor and or the subject area. Well, now you have the space of the remaining semester to maybe move a little bit further in that direction. And it works out at the end of the day. It's nothing to really be, you know, gnashing teeth or getting crazy over, because we know you're going to get a decent education of whatever direction you turn in, and you just got to, again, just kind of remain open-minded and you'll be fine. But happy to take some questions, things maybe we're coming in on, we're thinking about that we're not answering thus far, or we could talk about.
Is there any type of balance we should try to take with taking like core law classes and like a seminar and practical skills, or should we strive to find, you know, to find a balance? So take a few of each type, or?
You know, you've heard this. I don't know how. You probably lost count after the first week in terms of it depends or some version of it. But it really does. I know that I have counseled third-year students who will come in with the informal transcript and say, I don't know what to take, and I'm looking at it. And if I do a decent job of drilling down, I'll see that there are virtually no paper-based courses there. I think that's a mistake. I think that you're going to be nary a professor is going to, is not going to have some obligations in writing something. Memoranda, to be sure, but some, client memos, whatever it might be. And to not be building upon the skills in legal rhetoric, to me, is just a flat-out now mistake. So a student who has avoided that, I'm going to push in that direction. Large classes, no reason to avoid large classes. They're going to be typically some of more of your overview classes, and so they're larger by nature because they are popular. Your BA, your evidence, your wills, your tax. Makes perfect sense to take them. Some of the faculty, by and large, are going to push students even more than they did, or maybe ease up on the Socratic method, but maybe even push it more and say, I want this to be interactive and students being involved. The skill sets, we could debate the kind of hit the ground running. At the same time, as we say, the more you can develop yourself as a student, the easier it's going to be to market yourself to a prospective employer. I also know some prospective employers that say, listen, how much can we expect students to know when they graduate school? I mean, if I've been working in this area, in this department for 5-7 years to build my expertise, and it's taken me 5-7 years to get there, what do I expect from a graduate, from May to start in August or September or whenever, to be able to say, okay, go and do. They're going to tell you to go and do, but they have only certain, limited expectations right out of the chute. So I'm punting on the answer a little bit. I think if I were to give a specific answer, yeah, it would be balance. But it's balance that's being driven in large part by, to me, what should be the most obvious, which is you either came to school with something in mind, so explore that a little bit more, or you came to law school saying, well, I don't like the sight of blood, so I'm not going to med school, and I don't really think I have a business head, and I want to get a grad degree, so law seems to be the default, in which case I'm going to build myself as, a well-developed, well-rounded attorney. And if something sticks and I want to move further in that direction, great. If it doesn't, I'm just going to keep plugging away and keep, just building up assets in different areas. I don't know if you feel differently the matter. You're welcome to disagree.
No, I think it is a balance. Please, one thing I will say, and I think I can say this on the podcast, don't try to take evidence BA personal income tax, and don't do that.
It's just all in the fall.
All in the fall. That's just not a good idea. You want to also keep in mind you're going to have other commitments and obligations, whether it be law review, whether it be moot court mock trial. A lot of students, when they're in their option where they're writing their comment, they'll take a lighter course load because when you're writing your comment, it is that in itself can be a full-time job. So make sure that when you're considering not just your curricular activities, but your extracurricular activities, that you don't overload yourself. I agree with everything that Dean said.
Journal credits in particular, for those of you who may end up writing an option that takes you to the fall or spring, you might decide to plan ahead and have that semester be a lighter semester, recognizing that you earn 2 credits a journal during your first year on journal, your second year overall, but you can float those forward or back, meaning you can have placed them both in the fall, both in the spring, or split them, since you will be doing work throughout the semester in which you're doing the comment, you're going to be busy. And so some students will decide, I know the average credit burden I need is 14, I may drop as few as 12 in the fall semester or even in the spring semester, but maybe in the fall if I'm on option for the fall, knowing that I've got a little bit more time to work on that comment and it's really not pushing my average of remaining credits up that much higher. Again, picking up those 2 credits. I mean, you could debate doing 12 credits plus the 2 for 14, which puts you right on average, or doing a combination that has you at the bare minimum, 10 credits, 3 classes conceivably, and working on a note or comment and maybe having some time for some additional volunteer work or student organization work, whatever else, might float your boat in that regard. Other questions? I know we're kind of drilling. For those of you on the podcast, there are about 8 of us. I can't even count. 8 of us in the room, 8 students with us. So we're kind of looking at everybody and saying, force questions. But you don't have to.
Yeah. What are some of the other classes that tend to be prerequisites for a wide variety of things? Like BA was a prerequisite for all the business things. But what other classes tend to be like that?
Depends on the program. Keep in mind, I would say the program, if you will, and this is that has probably the most prerequisites outside of, I guess, the business law curriculum of BA, is the clinic. you know, evidence is a prerequisite for some clinics, not all of them, and a co-requisite for others. Also keep in mind that some clinics, for example, if you're interested in doing the tax clinic, you must take federal personal income tax before you enroll in the tax clinic. If you want to do the IP clinic, you have to take at least one IP course. So keep that in mind as well. If you're on this track where you want to participate in clinic in your third year, and it's a clinic, you know, immigrant justice clinic, you need to take immigrant. So just keep that in mind as well when you're selecting, especially the survey courses. But outside of that, I mean, trial advocacy evidence is a co-requisite, so you can take it at the same time as trial advocacy. We really don't have many prereqs in the school, which is actually the nice thing, because you can really build your schedule as you wish without being confined to these boxes of prerequisites.
Federal personal income tax, not a hard requisite, but will be a prerequisite for a couple of advanced tax courses. But again,
yeah.
You find that student comes to me and says, I want to jump into IP, but I missed the, you know, intro or the general IP course. We may look a little bit at your background and see if there's a little bit that might help, but typically I'll actually send the student to the professor who's teaching the course and have him or her have a go at it with the professor and say, this is what I'm coming in with, and the professor, in most cases, are going to say, come in and take the class, you should be okay. But, you know, there's some areas that say an absolute, you know, absolute lacking, the total background might say, well, you know, I think even there you can probably still get away with it in most cases, quite honestly. And that's why, as Myra says, there are very few formal prereqs. I mean, I think the only one that we even cite on the for upper level courses in the academic guide is the BA for some of the
is a prereq for securities and along corporate law classes.
About the externship, if we want to have an externship in the fall, I mean, is that okay? I mean, should we get more courses under our,
I'll take that one.
Yeah.
Let me take that one. Okay. Well, remember, the externship, if you're doing it for the first time in the fall, is going to be at max 6 credits. So 3 credits for your seminar and then 3 credits for field work if you do 20 hours per week. I've found in counseling students that students are still able to manage having an externship and getting in the coursework that they want to take. You may have to give and take on a couple of things and wait until the subsequent semester, or if it's a course that's only offered in the fall, you know, the following fall semester to take that class. But people are able to get in, you know, the core classes and other survey courses that they want to take with an externship. Externship seminar meets twice a week, I think. It's a Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday. It's like, it's a 3 credit, so it's a twice a week, hour and 20 minutes, you know, for each class. But really, you know, and that's kind of where the fieldwork component comes in. If you're someone who wants to do an externship, but you also want to be able to take classes that you're interested in, don't commit to a 20-hour per week externship. And do less hours at your externship so that it frees you up for more time to take the classes that you want. And that's a give and take. That's a balance that you as the student have to do. But I think it's an issue. I think you should do an externship. I think externships are great. Our externship program here is fantastic. But just, you know, if you're going to commit to an externship, make sure that you're reasonable in terms of how much time you want to commit to that versus how much time you want to spend in the classroom.
And considering the numbers, if you end up putting in the full hours in the field, that 6 credits externship, if you haven't taken Crim Pro, you're up to 9 with Crim Pro, you're looking at probably 2 more classes. So it may end up being just those 2 elective courses that you're looking to take. And that may go back to your question, which is, well, am I limiting myself in terms of other overview courses? I don't want to call it a trade-off because that makes it sound negative. There are students who will, you know, not only drive great pleasure from the externship, but have 2 potential components, you know, coming out from it. One is it deepens an interest in an area where they want to take additional courses, or again, they could run from it. You could invest a semester in an externship and say, okay, this is a subject area in which I don't want to spend any more time again. And the good news is I took it during the fall. I have 3 semesters remaining to actually kind of move into another area. And then back on the flip side, if it goes well, not only developing the networking opportunities, but also having it on your resume for other potential employers and saying, yeah, I was so much interested in this area. I went out right out of the chute, you know, first opportunity I could, and gained some practical skill sets in that area. And, you know, I've got something to talk about and to write up about as well in terms of resume, cover letter and all. So
if you have if you know what you want to do and you have a focus, let's say, you know, if you want to do intellectual property, you want to do maybe like trademark law or something, and you see that you want to do that in your third year, is it more important to get, BA, tax, evidence, and wills out of the way your second year? Like, make sure that those are complete and that you have more time to focus on other things, or is it kind of more flexible where you could kind of maybe push, I don't know, maybe push, like, not evidence or tax or something to your third year?
I think it depends when you're interested. I mean, my rule of thumb would be if you know you have an area of interest or you think you do, start moving in that direction. Don't overload. Again, you know, kind of keeping a balance of mind. So it's this isn't an it depends answer. I think it's a balance answer, which is, you know, if you're thinking about IT, move into IP. I mean, maybe it could just be the one course in the fall, but maybe it's the overview, or maybe you took it already, you know, taking it this semester, you already have it out of the way. I think you want to take at least the one class and then know that you have the remaining semesters. Maybe if you say, wow, this is definitely it for me, you could be taking two courses each semester in that area, and you're going to pick up between six and eight courses, depending what you've done in that field, and then consider building some of those other classes around it. I think what you don't want to do is end up in the back end and say, I'm you know, now looking at a bar exam, I'm looking, you know, I know the advisor said don't worry about checking off all the courses that are likely to appear on the bar, but, you know, my GPA is not as stellar as I would like to have been, which probably means I wasn't grasping materials as readily as some of my classmates were, and I'm looking up and seeing that, you know, Wills and Tax and BA, you know, on top of evidence, which I already knew, are all likely to be, if not in the case of evidence, actually appearing on the bar, and I've taken none of them, and then you start freaking out and saying, you know, my last semester, I wanted to get, you know, a couple of other courses under my belt of interest, I'm feeling really hard pressed to, you know, get all those in. So it's a mix and match. I think that would be my answer. Other questions?
No other
group. We might.
No other questions. Maybe they want to go off the record.
We can do that. well, it's about 4:35 on the podcast, so you know you've run about 35 minutes. We're going to turn it off here, and for those of you who are listening in, if there are additional questions you have at that point in time, as we say always, come and find Myra or me, and we're happy to meet with you, and we'll go from there.